In his book, Francis Collin writes this. He says, "If faith was a psychological crutch, I concluded, it must be a very powerful one. If it was nothing more than a veneer of cultural tradition, which means people just believe because that's what their parents believe. That's what everybody else around them. It's part of the culture." He says, "If it's just a veneer of cultural tradition, why were these people not shaking their fists at God and demanding that their friends and family stop all of this talk about a loving and benevolent supernatural power?" And again, looking at Dr. Francis's experience, and he doesn't talk a lot about it in the video, but in his book, and from I haven't read his book entirely, or I haven't read his book, but from what I've read or what I've heard, he interacts with a lot of people that are terminal, people that are struggling and are the worst point in their life, especially as a physician. And so to see the people's response, to see how people respond to who God is, that touched him. That changed his mentality, that changed his approach. And Jesus predicted this, not specifically about Francis Collins, but Jesus predicted that's what it would take. And John was the vehicle or helped accomplish this. And we talked about this last week. We talked about the purpose, and I'll read the purpose here again in just a second, of why John wrote what he wrote. But looking at the whole idea of faith and belief and trust, we're not ever told. In fact, it's the exact opposite of what we're told in the New Testament by the authors. None of the New Testament writers, John or Matthew or Paul, ever say, "You just got to believe. You just got to believe. Well, you just got to take it by faith. It's, you know, that's just the way it is," kind of a thing, and wishful thinking and hopeful thinking. Because all of them point to, and I say John especially, point to this truth and this fact that there is evidence available to what they believe. In fact, John writes in his first letter, the first verse, first chapter, he says, "That which was from the beginning," and beginning meaning Jesus' ministry and when he begins doing what he did, "from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life." What we have seen, what we have heard, what we have touched. John was there, right? John was there from the very beginning. One of the first disciples. In fact, he was one that outlived all the other disciples. And so he was around a lot longer than the others. But he saw and he heard and he experienced Jesus. And he gives us and shares that with us in so many ways. But John's experience is also really kind of interesting because he wasn't a really, and most of the disciples weren't. None of them, very few of them, were really prominent or wealthy or powerful people in their day, right? And John maybe especially, right? He was a simple fisherman, grew up in a simple Jewish home, you know, always believing in God, Yahweh God. And it was to me, it was a very simple faith. And he was only going to take and receive the things that he saw and he heard and he experienced. To be able to be what's necessary for him, to be able to believe or trust something in his life. And to me, the fact that he was, a simple man, right, being a fisherman, growing up in a simple home, probably had very little education, if any education, and the fact that something changed for him, that he went through his life living one way, one belief, having, you know, who God is and what he was doing in this world, and something happened in his life, something experienced in his life shifted everything for him. And for me, that's such a huge part of what we read in the New Testament, what we read especially in John's gospel for him, but all the other gospels as well. And so when John writes, he tells us at the end of his book, or towards the end of his book, why he writes. So John 20, 30, and 31, he says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book." You know, lots of things that Jesus did, we just don't have the room. I didn't want to put them all down, so this is, but this is what I wrote. And he says, "But these are written, so that you may believe." The audience reading this originally, us that are reading it a couple thousand years later, "that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." And so we saw last week how John had signs, kind of like these road signs. He has seven of them that point to a specific purpose for who Jesus is. And so I just, you know, I use sermon or communion meditation about, you know, an uncharted territory and that path limit image, because I think it's such an important image for us in life, is that path. And what are we seeing? What are we allowing to direct and move our lives forward? And so John gives us kind of that image, too, of being on a path and these signs. And they're miracles, and I may use the word miracle as we go through this, but they're more than miracles. They're pointing to a specific purpose and direction for us to look and follow. And so, like John says, it's written for that purpose, that we may believe that Jesus is who he says he was, and that he came to give us life. And so what we're going to look at is the second miracle, second sign this morning. And it's interesting how last week's message and this week's message kind of fit together, but how they're unique as well. And so I kind of want to pause, and if you want to get your phone out and watch last week's quick, and then you can pick. No, I'm just kidding. All right. You'll have to go back and watch it if you weren't here last week. But we're in John chapter 4. This is, again, the second sign, the second miracle that we see that John gives us. And again, there's so many things that are similar to last week's, but John chapter 4 is such a unique chapter because it gives us a lot of historical and cultural information and background that to me is really, really neat. And the beginning of that chapter, or most of that chapter, is about Jesus' interaction with the woman at the well, right? The Samaritan woman at the well. And most of us know that story pretty well. We're going to skip that whole story because the sign shows up here towards the end of the chapter. But that story is important because it begins to start to show us what one of the reasons that this sign is important for us, the second sign is important for us thousands of years later. But John chapter 4 kind of comes in between, or the beginning of John chapter 4 comes in between these two miracles in a lot of ways. And if you know where, and you don't, I don't know a lot about Israel's geography, but Israel's kind of a longer country, right? And where he was at for the first miracle was Cana in Galilee, and that's more in the northern part of the country. From there, in that wedding that Jesus saved, you know, saves the wedding and, you know, rescues, you know, all the whatever things that would happen if a wedding failed, that kind of thing, he goes south to Jerusalem, and I believe it's for Passover. And so he travels south to Jerusalem in the Judea area for a while, and now he's on his way back. In John chapter 4, he's going back. And in order to get from the southern part of the country where Jerusalem is back to Cana in Galilee, he has to go through or around Samaria. And that's why he interacts, or when he interacts, with the Samaritan woman at the well. What's really cool, as much as, like I said, I would love to go over John chapter 4 and the Samaritan woman too, but we're all tired because we all lost a lot of sleep, so I won't go into that. But what happens in there is really telling at the end. Because of what Jesus does, because of this interaction, because of the way the woman experiences Jesus, she goes and she tells her whole town about this. Right, and she expresses what she's experienced, what Jesus told her, and all these things. And at the end of that section, in verse 39, this is what happens. Many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony that he had told me all that I ever did. The words of this woman, that what she tells the rest of the town, many come to faith in him because of that testimony. And there's a foreshadowing of this story into what Jesus does for a second sign, second miracle. So if you have your Bible or Bible app, we're in verse 46, and we'll kind of break it up here as we go through it. But John 4, 46, it says, "So when Jesus came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water into wine," in case you forgot, he did that there, "and at Capernaum there was an official whose son was ill." And again, I don't have a lot of time to go into the comparison and contrast of all these different things that are happening. I wish I would have had a little more time to study that and be able to express that to you. But if nothing else, right, they're in the same location. There's the same, you know, same setup, that kind of stuff. But there's two very different things happening here. The first time we see Jesus turning water into wine to save the wedding, right? His mama shows up and says, "There's a problem, you know, fix this," kind of a thing. And so so he does, and he saves this wedding. He takes care of it, this joyful, this celebration of this family coming together, this, you know, wonderful weddings are, you know, a happy time. And in contrast to that is what's happening to this official son, right? And his son is ill. We'll read later on that he's to the point of death. And so these two stories happening in the same location, very different context. But the cool thing about this is that Jesus is willing to engage in both the happy celebration, exciting time of life, and the time where it's hardest and darkest for people. And so Jesus is willing to step into both. But also want to point out a couple of key things here. First is this official was from Capernaum. And from Capernaum to Cana was about an 8-hour walk. For me, it'd probably be about a 10-hour walk because I like to walk nice and slow. But for others, Generally, I think it was about 15 miles, if I remember right. But 8-hour walk, unless you had a chariot or a horse, then you could get there in 2 to 3 hours. And so that there's that distance, there's a time in between there that's significant for the story. But the second thing is that this is a royal official. This official is a Jewish aristocrat, and so he would have had some wealth, and he would have had some influence. And so we know then probably he would have had the resources so that he would have ridden in a chariot. He wouldn't have been walking to get to Jesus. It also probably meant that he was a Sadducee. And a Sadducee, we kind of know there's two major groups in the Jewish culture in the Temple Jerusalem area. The Pharisees, and we know the Pharisees pretty well, the legalistic, they keep the law, very devout, very much about what to do, a faith in God that asked him for a lot of things and praised him about a lot of things. But the Sadducees were a very intellectual group. In fact, they were very deterministic, which I think is a really interesting group. They thought that everything happened by God's command, basically, that everything was preordained, everything was accomplished because of what God did. And so for that, and this is important, I think, for the story, Sadducees didn't ask God for things. They didn't pray to God, please give me this, or provide me this, or I need this, right? They just thought everything was already determined, fate decided, outcomes, and so whether it was how many kids you had, whether it was if you got married or not, whether your health, everything kind of fell under the side that, well, it's just fate. That's the way it's going to happen. And we probably know people in our culture that are like that too, and still today. But that was their nature, and that was their understanding. But on this day, as we can see, no matter what he believes, no matter what his background is, this father, because his son is so ill, is willing to brush aside all of those things. Everything may be decided, but it's my son, right? And we've been there. Most of us have experienced something similar, where it was an incredibly hard situation. A situation where, loved ones passing away, or we've experienced something, turmoil in our life that's caused us to be like, I don't care what I've believed in the past. I don't care, what I've thought in the past. I need to do something different. I need to try anything or everything to be able to fix the situation. And I think that's where this official is. He could believe all these different kinds of things, have all of these things in his head, but his son is sick. So he's got to do something. And so we see in verse 47 what he does. It says, when this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea up to Galilee, he went to him, and he asked him to come down and heal his son, for his son was near the point, or was at the point of death. We know for sure that Jesus had shown up in Cana of Galilee and turned water into wine. But he's also been doing other miracles and other things in other parts of Jerusalem or in Israel as well. And so this man, if nothing else, this official, probably at least heard about the water into wine, right? He heard a rumor, he heard a story. Someone was at that wedding and had come and told him, well, Jesus did this crazy thing and it was amazing wine and all this kind of, whatever the story is. And so this official never met Jesus. He's never interacted with him, but he's heard things. There's been people telling him about this or about that. And so it's because of those things that he decides to do something. And my mind just works this way. And so if this bothers you, just ignore this part and we'll skip on from it. But my mind goes to the official's wife. And she hears, and regardless of what the official thinks or what he feels, this wife has heard about Jesus. And so she brings her husband over and she says, honey, you go get that man, you bring him here, right? No, I don't know. Anyway, that's how my mind works. And she probably didn't, and who knows what happened. But, she's probably a driving force, just like, Jesus' mother was too. But, so this official has a decision to make, right? He could decide that he's just going to send a servant, right? And I'm guessing this official does that a lot. He's sending servants to take care of business. So he could send a servant to Jesus to bring Jesus here, right? But he realizes, I think, that he needs to do this himself. I think there's a deterministic, there's an attitude like, I need to handle this myself. If I go, then there's a much better chance that Jesus will respond. And so he's deciding what to do, and if he's willing to listen and to listen and hear what he's heard, or pay attention to what he's heard and what he's experienced from other people to make a decision on how to handle what to do. And so when he goes to Jesus, again, he asked him to come and help him. And this language here, now you can't see it in the English, but in the language here, the verb tense of asking Jesus to come is this kind of this, or not kind of, is this repetitive nature, asking over and over and over again. In fact, it's a very much a pleading mentality. And if you think about it, an official, this Jewish aristocrat that's had this power and authority, pleading with Jesus, probably maybe even, you know, begging on his knees or, you know, certainly swallowing his pride, he's asking Jesus, you need to come and do something. And so he's praying in the sense, right? He's praying because he's asking Jesus, who's, you know, God's son, to come and do something. And we've prayed that maybe, right? I know I've had prayers. I've never had a son in this situation, obviously, but I've prayed to God to say, you need to do something. You know, I've asked over and over again. There's a pleading, right? And if you had seen me, you know the way I was praying, I would probably been a little embarrassed the way I was, you know, pleading and asking. Most of us have probably been in a situation like that as well. And so the again, the official's asking, pleading, begging Jesus to do something, and Jesus responds this way, which is an interesting response. He says, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And that you is not a you just to the official. It's a plural you, it's y'all kind of an idea, right? So he's not just speaking directly to the official, he's speaking to the official's maybe entourage. He's speaking to his own disciples. He's talking to whoever is there and present. And he's saying this very distinct and specific thing, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And it's interesting, again, looking back at the story from last week, is the reprimand, right? He's kind of putting them in their place. He's saying, what is, you know, this is where you're at. Just like he put Mary in her place, right? And everybody probably around there too, when he says, woman, right? You guys remember that part, I think, right? Woman, why are you including me? Right? He's reprimanding them, saying, this is where you're at. And that's not where you should be, or not where I want you to be anyway. And so he's trying to get them to shift and to change their mentality to say, it's not necessarily about signs and wonders. It's not necessarily about seeing to believe. There's something more happening here. And so Jesus says this to him, and the official then responds. He says, sir, again pleading with him, sir, come down before my child dies. And it sounds a certain amount of confidence here, right? It sounds like he's sure that Jesus can do something, and maybe he is pretty confident. But at the same time, I think there's kind of two thoughts that the official's having here. His two thoughts or two options are, one, Jesus listens to him, hears his plea, and he comes and heals his son, and his son's, you know, restored. The other option is Jesus refuses and his son dies. Those are really the two options that I think are in the official's mind at this point. He has no other thoughts, no other options that are available. Jesus comes and he lives. Jesus doesn't and he dies. But at the same time, I think in the back of the official's mind is, I really have nothing to lose, right? If I don't go, if I don't ask Jesus, if I don't plead and beg with him to come, my son's going to die anyway, right? And even if he says no, I'm not really losing anything more because my son's already going to die anyway. And so it sounds a certain amount like confidence. But at the same time, it feels like maybe there's not much to lose. But the way that Jesus responds, the way that Jesus tells this official to react and to behave, is the same thing that he's going to ask people to do for the rest of history, and what he asked us to do as well. And so when Jesus responds to him in verse 50, he says, go. He says, basically, and that idea is just go and about your business. In fact, it's like, go finish your shopping here in Cana, go take care of your stuff. Don't rush home, just take care of stuff and everything will be fine. And so this language here is Jesus is saying, you got to trust me a little bit. You got to buy into me just a little bit in order for things to work out for you. You've got to trust the testimony of those that you've heard already, of what I've done, of what I've accomplished, to be able to move forward. But then Jesus leaves him with a promise. He says, go, and your son will live. There's a trust aspect here. There's an obedience aspect here. And the official's probably thinking, and maybe he's not thinking this, but I like to think this. He's thinking, I'm supposed to go home without you? right? But if I go home and my wife sees that I'm alone, there's going to be two deaths in my family, kind of a thing, right? But no, the nature of it, he just didn't have any other options. Come, Jesus comes and his son lives. Jesus doesn't come and his son dies. So Jesus throws out a third option, saying, go. I'm not going to go with you, but you go. You show a little bit of trust and belief in what you've heard and the testimony of those around you. And when you go and you get home, your son's going to be fine. And really, that's where all of us live. This idea of we've got to trust, we've got to believe, we've got to accept something that we didn't ever experience ourselves, because none of us, right, were able to be around when Jesus was around, right? Unless you've got a story that I'm not going to believe, probably. But we have to live in that tension. We have to live with that idea that we have to trust the testimony, we have to trust the experience, we have to trust what we read from John, to be able to know and understand who Jesus is. And so this story is really a lifetime reduced to a day. When Jesus says, go, your son will live, the official has to decide to do something, right? And he's tasking us to decide something as well. To go and to do something, to trust enough based upon the testimony of those around us. Not just maybe those around us, but the testimony of John, the testimony of Paul, the testimony of those that we've read. And like Francis Collins said, you know, as I read and studied and broke this down, there's overwhelming, and to me, there's overwhelming evidence that we can trust what we read, what John gave us, what Paul gave us, what Peter gave us. But we're asked to trust, and we're asked to take that testimony, those words, those experiences of those that were there, and to believe, and to take a step to be able to say, well, what does that mean? It's not a belief, like I talked about last week, that's just wishful thinking, or I hope it's true. It's trusting in those that have been there and done that and experienced that. But I also think it's an important part of this story as well, and this is maybe more for me, but maybe it helps you a little bit too, is it's not just the testimony of what we see from John or Paul or Matthew, but it's the testimony of those that are around us as well. And maybe it's a Sunday school teacher that you had in the past. Maybe it's a parent that you experienced. Maybe it's a friend that they shared something with you that they experienced. They shared something with you, or maybe it's even just a relationship you have with someone and you see in them and you see in their experience and you see the way that they responded. And you can see and understand that God is really at work in their lives. And for me, and I see that in a lot of you as well, and people that I've seen over the last, just even the last couple years, that the testimony they have, that the faith that they are able to continue to have and trust in who God is and what he's accomplished, to me is a major testimony to the fact that God is active and working in their life. And again, I hope you guys have seen that or experienced that with the people around you, with the people that we worship together with, and just in this room, in this building, in this place, but in this community, and that we're connected with, that their faith is a testimony. The fact that in the most maybe even hellish experiences of life, sure, it was hard. Sure, you can understand their pain and their tears and the things that they express. But the fact that they persevered, in fact, the fact that their faith really led them through that is a significant testimony to who God is and how he's working still in our world today. Which to me, again, goes to the point of where our testimonies are as well. And I like to, you know, a lot of times think of myself as John. You know, I try to live a simple life. You know, that's keep the chickens. They kind of keep me grounded a little bit too in terms of dealing with all their stuff. And you know, we don't have to have elaborate lives. We don't have to have, you know, the most eloquent speeches or anything that we have in our lives. We have a testimony that we can share with those around us as well. We have an experience with God that we can share. And in the midst of our, you know, unanswered prayers, and we all have unanswered prayers, right? In the midst of our struggles and the things that we've lost in this world, we can testify and have a testimony as well. Because do we really know who's always watching us? Not really. Do we know that when we say or do or or express part of our faith in some way, do we know how that's impacting those around us all the time? No, we can't. In fact, we don't even know that someone maybe in our lives is a day or a week or a month or, you know, within a year of coming to faith in Jesus because of our faithfulness and the testimony that we have as well. And so this story is a life, as our lives condensed to a day. And you can imagine how the official's feeling, because a lot of us have probably been there. That's not the answer I expected, Jesus. That's not the way I wanted you to say and answer this for me. In fact, I imagine, and again, I go down this road probably too many times where I imagine how they're feeling. I imagine he's a little annoyed with Jesus. Maybe getting a little angry or upset. And it's weird in the text because it's the only thing separating what Jesus tells him and what he decides to do is a period. But I imagine there's a pause there. Maybe there's a certain amount of looking around. What do I do? How do I respond to what Jesus just said? But he chose to walk away. Verse 50 says, go 50 here. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him. He went on his way. And so he walked home by faith, not by sight. He trusted enough from what he heard from Jesus, from what he heard from others, to go home. And most of us know how the story ends, but I want to read it anyway because it's a good ending. And he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So the official asked them the hour that he began to get better, and they said, yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left. And the father knew that that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, your son will live. And so the official trusted and had a certain amount of blind faith. And I talked about last week how blind faith isn't enough. But he started there. He started with, this is what I've heard. This is what I've seen. This is what I've experienced. I may not have seen a miracle from Jesus with my own eyes, but I've experienced enough and heard enough to do what Jesus tells me to do. But then something shifts when he hears that his son will live, when he experiences that evidence. That not only does he trust enough to go home, but he came in verse 53 and 54, and he himself believed in all of his household. And this was the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. And so we're at that place where we have to trust the testimony of people that wrote thousands of years ago and the testimony of those around us, that Jesus is who he said he was, that Jesus came to die for our sins, to be rose and raised from on the third day. And so we have to take a certain amount of steps of that faith, of walking by faith. And I just to kind of close with this morning, that idea of walking by faith, again, is not just a hopeful, wishful thinking. It's not just, oh, well, I really want this to be true, so I'm gonna trust it. But that walking by faith takes all that we know, all that we've experienced, the things that we can read in the New Testament especially, and says, okay, what steps do I have to take to move forward? And walking by faith means living each and every single day as if what we read and what we experience and what we've seen is true. That Jesus truly is who he says he was, that he came, again, to die on the cross, to walk on this earth and to live and to teach and to show us, but to, like I said, ultimately die on the cross and to be raised to life. And the love that God showed to us through Jesus is by walking by faith, is expressing that love every single day, in every single situation, in every single relationship. And to say, I'm going to walk by faith, I'm going to trust, not because I really hope this to be true, but because I can see that it's true. And just like Dr. Collins said, he saw the evidence, he saw what was there, he could reason and rationalize it and understand it. And so he chose to live every day, just like we can choose every day, to walk by that faith and expressing that love. Well, let's pray. Gracious Father, we thank you so much for the testimony of those that have seen and experienced and heard you. But I also thank you so much for the testimony of those in this room and those connected with us that I have in my life that show evidence of who you are and what you've accomplished. And I'm just so thankful to be able to see those things, to know those things. And I trust through that testimony, through the testimony of those that have gone before me, and the testimonies that of those that I walk along with today, that I know you love us so much, and that Jesus truly is the Son of God and the Savior of our world.